One of the most resisted sayings of Jesus in the Bible has to be, "Do not worry." Anybody here get that 100% of the time? We think, easy for you to say, Jesus. And then worse, we have the gift of Catholic guilt, gift that keeps on giving, saying to us, if you are worried, then you've failed. You aren't doing it right. You aren't trusting God enough. Well, Mike Boucher and Bill Welch's Lenten group was grappling with this passage on Monday, and as Mike pointed out, Jesus is probably talking here about worry about the little things, the minutiae that can become consuming for our thoughts. What am I going to cook for dinner? How many emails do I have to send before I go home from work? What's my boss going to think? What's my family member going to think? The things that we know our older selves are going to be rolling their eyes at, looking back at them. We can almost hear ourselves saying with hindsight, oh goodness, why did I fritter my days away thinking about that? So, of course, those are good kinds of anxieties to let go of, saves us a lot of grief. But we all feel, well, what if Jesus is talking about the bigger worries? Somebody here, I'm sure, is worried about test results that they're waiting on. Somebody here is worried because their spouse left them. Somebody here worries about their kid who is living with addiction. And we are all worried about the state of our country, our Constitution, and our democracy right now. These worries, I feel sure Jesus would have had compassion for and would have shared himself. And we know that Jesus himself had anxiety from time to time. In the Garden of Gethsemane, when he was facing his mortality, we know that his worries kept him up to all hours. He had sleepless nights just like we do, and they drove him to tears. He said, "My soul is troubled," that's what the Gospels say, meaning I'm worried, I'm really worried. In the Gospel we heard today, when Jesus goes up the mountain, this comes at a time when he had to be feeling some fear. He was looking at the road ahead, a road that by now he has figured out leads to Jerusalem, to the capital, to protest. And he knew that on that road ahead lay the likelihood of bumping up against the authorities and facing persecution and suffering. So as he thinks about this, Jesus goes up the mountain to pray. And there he ends up gathering strength for what's ahead. He hears again the voice that God spoke to him at his baptism. "This is my beloved." It's good for all of us to intentionally reconnect with our baptism. Remember God's love for us, God's words to us since the day we were born, that we are beloved too. My pastor that I grew up with back in Syracuse spoke of a time like this for him when, as a young gay man in the 70s, he worried about whether he would be accepted for who he was, accepted by his family, accepted by his friends, by society. He lived with those painful wonderings for many years. And we all wonder, for reasons of our own, I think, will anybody love me? Will I be deemed okay? And then one day, it seemed out of nowhere, he heard a voice. I don't think he heard it with his ears, but I think it was a voice that echoed within. And all of a sudden, it ceased to matter what anybody else thought, having anybody else's approval. Because he said, "I knew then that God loved me." And it was so certain, it was like 2 + 2 = 4. It came to him as this unshakable bedrock truth. And ever after, the world was different. So Jesus reconnects with that knowing. This is his moment like that. And it's good for all of us to try to reconnect with that. I like to walk along the Genesee River here in town and just think about my baptism, just recall that. Any body of water will do to remind us of the sacred waters that we came from. And this time, God's voice also has some instructions for the disciples. "This is my beloved son, so listen to him," God says. What are the hallmarks of a person or a nation that listens to Jesus? Such a person would live the Beatitudes, right? Would prioritize the poor, the excluded, the powerless, the vulnerable, making sure their needs are put at the center, just as they'll be put first in the kingdom of God, Jesus tells us over and over. Such a person would be all about peacemaking, beating swords into plowshares. So a little nudge to Peter and James and John here about not just worshiping Jesus, but following Jesus more closely. Peter wants to bottle this mystical experience they're having on the mountain. It's good for us to be here, he says. He's riding this spiritual high, and he says, let's make three tents. Let's camp out here and stay here forever, just basking in this glorious feeling. But the point isn't to have a mosh pit experience on Sunday, that would be like our equivalent, and otherwise remain unchanged. So far, Peter, James, and John have been doing a good bit of blustering about their own glory and wanting Jesus to do stuff for them, but have missed a lot about what he's trying to tell them about his way of life of peace and nonviolence. So now God makes one more attempt to persuade them to take another look at what following Jesus really means. Jesus also insists that they return back down the mountain, back to their everyday lives, back to their ministry. The measure of faith is what difference it makes for us Monday through Saturday. What matters is what we do with the holy moments we experience. You think of Abraham in the first reading. It says he found himself in a trance, that is, his consciousness shifted by a holy moment in nature out under the stars. And we've had our times when the beauty and the majesty of creation has led us to awe. But the question is, what will we carry with us after the intensity of that first feeling is gone? Will we see the world differently? The Canadian environmentalist David Suzuki writes, "The way we see the world shapes how we treat it. If the mountain is a deity, not a pile of ore, if a river is one of the veins of the land, not a potential source of irrigation, if a forest is a sacred grove, not timber, if other species are kin, not resources, and if the planet is our mother, not an opportunity, then we will treat all of them with more respect. The challenge is to look at the world from a different perspective." Jesus, for his part, is visibly changed by this moment of closeness to God. We have no doubt that he is changed. His disciples seem to perceive him as radiant and incandescent. And you think of your own God-soaked moments, holding your child or grandchild as a newborn for the first time, the day you met the love of your life, feeling the tug on your heart that told you you'd found the thing you were meant to do in the world. Didn't you walk around luminous for the rest of the day? Couldn't even other people see it, that you were lit up from within? So what consoled Jesus? He had just as many worries as he did yesterday. Seems unlikely they just evaporated. But he came down strengthened to meet whatever would come. What happened to him up there on the summit? We're told that Jesus was conferring with Moses and Elijah, so he was speaking with the ancestors, with the heroes gone before. Moses and Elijah also represent the two great strands of wisdom in his Jewish religious tradition. Moses stands for the law, Elijah stands for the prophets. So we're meant to read this as Jesus was drawing strength from the deep well of his religion. He remembered the good troublemakers among his spiritual predecessors in whose footsteps he stood, and he felt them standing with him, keeping him on his course. And this is a good practice for us today, too. Draw strength from the best of our faith, from the Mass, from music, from the Eucharist, from Catholic teaching on social justice, the earth, the poor. And remember the trailblazers. Remember the Anthonys and the Douglases, the Eleanor Roosevelts, the Dr. Kings, the John Lewises, Gandhi, St. Francis, the whole communion of saints who've struggled through the centuries before us. Remember the hardships they braved. And imagine what encouragements they'd say to us now, facing what we do today. Jesus also brings other people with him up the mountain. He doesn't go this alone. He needs his community, Peter, James, and John, while he discerns what to do and while he gathers his strength. Another underappreciated antidote to worry is community. When we feel not alone, we're stronger and braver. All of you guys, we make each other braver. I don't know about you all, but it's hard for me to imagine life ever being devoid of worry. I can't quite imagine reaching a point where I can cast all worries off and watch them float away like feathers down a stream. But what Jesus discovered on the mountain is some things are stronger than worry. Conviction in our faith and a sense of purpose is stronger than worry. Community is stronger than worry. Love is stronger than worry. Recently, a member of our parish said to me, "I can't solve any of the problems of the world, but there is one time in my life when they don't weigh me down, when I don't feel afraid. And that is when I'm playing with my grandchildren. Holding them, listening to them, I can't feel afraid," he said. "It's like it's not even a possibility. When we feel a love that big and that strong, there just isn't as much room to be afraid. And even if we don't have one single person in our life who quite lights us up like this, this truth breaks in for all of us. The Polish poet Anna Kamienska describes gratitude as scattered homeless love. Love without a specific object or destination. Love that's just roving around out there. Gratitude is also stronger than worry. Kamienska writes, "I want to thank everyone for the fact that they exist. I'm grateful to the young leaves that they are still willing to open up to the sun. I'm grateful to all the babies that they still felt like coming into this world. I could have kissed the hands of the person to whom I gave my seat on the bus this morning. I want to thank the storm for throwing a rainbow in my face." If you visit the actual site of Mount Tabor in the Holy Land, the mountain, so-called, that Luke was referring to in this gospel, you see that it isn't really a mountain. It could generously be called a hill. It's this little grassy knoll. It's not impressive looking at all. Which tells us that they can happen anywhere, these moments that light the world up for us and make it impossible to only worry. It doesn't have to be Mount Everest. It could be Cobb's Hill. It could be any ordinary place along the hard path each of us is walking. Around every corner, God's encouragement awaits us to remember our baptism, to heed Jesus' voice, to gather friends on earth and in heaven, and stay the course in doing what's right.